Welcome to episode 536 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is going to be series 115. One thing I will encourage you to do is there is a worksheet that is attached to this podcast. So if you can, I will strongly encourage you to print out the worksheet and annotate it as we go through this podcast. Or if you want to take it as a quiz at the end of this podcast, that is absolutely fine. Or if you even want to preview before you listen to this podcast, that is absolutely fine. If you're like, oh, I want to get the best learning from this, my recommendation is preview. Just real quick, spend like a minute before you listen to the podcast. And then listen to the podcast and then take it as a quiz at the end. An alternative is preview for like a minute or two before you listen to the podcast and then annotate as you go through the podcast. And then just this worksheet, go through it down the line. All right. So what if they give you a question about an old guy and you're told that this man is having to crank up the TV whenever he's watching an NBA game or he's watching golf or he's watching a basketball game, and they'll tell you that his grandkids always complain that the TV is set too loud. Well, what should you be thinking about there? I would hope you're saying, oh, wait, Divine, this is a pretty classic case of presbycusis. This person has presbycusis. Sometimes on the exams, they may call it an age-related hearing loss. So what's the big deal with presbycusis? Well, the key thing to know here is that it's a kind of sensory neural hearing loss. Again, remember, the USMLEs these days, I've said this so many times on this podcast, they deal in derivatives. They deal in what? Derivatives. So basically, they take what you know and express it in other terms. So sometimes, instead of putting presbycusis as an answer or putting age-related hearing loss as an answer, they can literally put sensory neural hearing loss as an answer. Presbycusis is a kind of sensory neural hearing loss. So what usually causes this? Well, for the most part, the structures in your inner ear degenerate, right? So like your cochlea is just not working great in case they ask you about pathophase. You know, your cochlea is degenerating. Your organ of Corti, that's like the sensory organ for hearing in your inner ears, doesn't work as great. You're losing like stereocilia. That's why you may wonder like, wow, Divine, why is it that people that have Alport syndrome, they have hearing problems? Well, the thing is the type 4 collagen that they're lacking. Remember, it's a COL4E5 gene mutation. The type 4 collagen they're lacking as part of your inner ear structure. So the stereocilia is lost. And these people, again, when they have presbycusis, it's high frequency hearing loss that they have. And usually it's going to be bilateral. And here's the thing. Presbycusis is the most common cause of hearing loss. I'm going to say that again. Presbycusis is the most common cause of hearing loss. Again, remember, our friends at the NBMEs care a lot about these most common causes these days. And you may wonder, like, Divine, is this something that gets better? Unfortunately, not really. Because the thing is, most mammals, they can regenerate their cochlear sensory cells, their organ of Corti and whatnot, or at least sensory structures in their inner ears. But human beings cannot. Human beings cannot. And since I guess we're talking about hearing loss, remember our friends at the NBMEs, they can slap on some other hearing loss vignettes on your exams, right? So especially with drugs, I don't know why people just ignore this, but it's one of these things that's pretty high yield to know for your exams. So for example, they can give you a question about a person that is being treated for some kind of pseudomonal infection. And obviously, and you notice that they develop hearing loss. You want to think about an aminoglycoside like gentamicin. Remember, the aminoglycosides certainly cause hearing loss. I mean, you can also think of the aminoglycosides with people that have cystic fibrosis. I remember people that have CF, we tend to give them inhaled tobramycin as their treatment for pseudomonas. Remember, people that have CF over the age of 20, the most common cause of pneumonia in those folks is pseudomonas aeruginosa. Tobramycin is an aminoglycoside. It covers pseudomonas pretty well. So they can pretty much create any kind of aminoglycoside vignette with gentamicin, tobramycin, neomycin, right? Neomycin, I believe, sometimes is used as bowel prep in certain procedures. So neomycin, you know, amikacin, just keep those in mind. Or they can give you a question about a person that is being treated for some kind of malignancy, you know, like testicular cancer, for example, and they develop hearing loss. You want to think about cisplatin. Those platinum agents, they are very, very big on ototoxicity. And then they can give you a question about a person being treated for CHF. Remember, your loop diuretics, especially ethacrynic acid, love to cause drug-induced ototoxicity, drug-induced hearing loss. Or they can give you a question about a person that recently had an MI, and this person has been on chronic pharmacotherapy since. And then the person develops hearing loss, especially when you're taking big doses. Or they can give you a question about a person that has like Dressler syndrome or like a post-MI pericarditis. Then you want to think about aspirin. Remember, aspirin, especially in high doses, the salicylates, they can cause hearing loss. Again, you can see all the integrations they can make with this stuff. I know it may be like hearing loss is not high yield for the exam. I promise you it's really high yield, right? Or you get a question about a person that came into the hospital for C. diff treatment, you know, and this person then developed hearing loss afterwards. You want to think about vancomycin. Remember, vanc can cause hearing loss. Vanc is ototoxic. Vanc is what? Is ototoxic. And again, there are many vanc vignettes they can write, right? We use vanc to literally cover MRSA. We don't cover C. diff. So they can give you like an IV drug user kind of situation, because IV drug users that develop endocarditis, they're probably going to be on vancomycin for some reason, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that is like super angry, has a lot of trouble sleeping, you know, has been having this constant feeling of hunger, perform poorly on a quiz or an exam, and that this person quit smoking like a week ago? What should you be thinking about? Well, I hope you're saying, wait, Divine, this sounds a lot like nicotine withdrawal. This person's withdrawing from nicotine. This person's withdrawing from nicotine, right? And the thing is, one unusual question you may see on your exam is they can ask you, like, which of the following brain neurotransmitters is responsible for this person's current symptoms or was responsible for the person's dependence on the substance? The answer is going to be dopamine. The answer is going to be dopamine. That's why nicotine is kind of hard to quit, because you see people, whenever you drink a nicotine drink, especially if you do it regularly, there's going to be a small amount of dopamine that is released in your brain. That's like the reward center. So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind. I mean, most of these things that are addictive, social media, scrolling on your phone, blah, 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 it's just associated with like some kind of dopamine reward. That's how addictions develop. And that's how withdrawal also kind of happens, because it's almost like you just feel like you're in such a horrible, horrible, horrible down state you can't seem to get out of. So what are we going to do for these people? Well, typically, when a person has nicotine withdrawal, we generally try to start off first line with nicotine withdrawal therapy. I mean, nicotine replacement, not withdrawal, whoops. Nicotine replacement therapy, like what? You want to think of something like a nicotine patch or a nicotine gum or just many different nicotine things you can try. And if that is alone is not controlling the person's symptoms, then you can add on pharmacotherapy. Don't stop the nicotine replacement therapy, but add on pharmacotherapy. So what do you add on as pharmacotherapy? Well, you can add on something like bupropion. That's an NDRI. Remember, it's a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor. You can add that on. But again, remember, don't give bupropion to people that have a history of seizure disorders, because it lowers the seizure threshold. Don't give it to people that have eating disorders, because they can have all these electrolyte problems like hyponatremia, hypokalemia, whatnot, that can cause them to have seizures. So don't give it to those people. Again, many people are used to these bupropion contraindications being tested just in people that are taking bupropion for depression, right? Because many people love bupropion for depression because it doesn't have sexual side effects. And it doesn't cause weight gain, actually causes weight loss. So people like it. But again, our friends at the MBMEs, it's not like they invent new topics to test. You know, every now and then they slot in a bunch of new topics. But what they usually do these days is that they just take what you know and test it in a fashion that is not very common for many people, right? Like testing bupropion contraindications in a person that is studying treatment for nicotine withdrawal. It's not something you think about all the time, but it's a classic thing they love to do on exams, right? Remember, another drug you can use if you don't want to use bupropion is you can use varenicline. Many of us know it as Chantix, I believe. This is a partial agonist at the nicotinic receptor. It's a partial agonist at the nicotinic receptor. Although the thing is, we try to be careful about varenicline. If a person has like a history of like serious psychiatric disorders, that can be problematic in those populations. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has been sleep deprived because, you know, they've been studying for some exam and, you know, they've not been getting enough sleep, and then they have this severe pain on the side of the head, like on the right side of the head, so on one side of the head, and they tell you that, man, this headache is throbbing, is pulsating. What should you be thinking about? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, divine, this is a migraine. This is a migraine, right? This is a migraine. This is a migraine. Don't overthink it. This is a clean cut case of a migraine. Clean cut case of a migraine. So what are you going to do for this person? Well, for a migraine, remember, you can use a serotonin receptor agonist like a triptan, like sumatriptan, for example, or you can use an NSAID. So here's the thing. If you don't see a triptan as an answer for migraines on your exams, consider using an NSAID. I kid you not, our friends at the MBMEs can give you a migraine question and the acute treatment is literally an NSAID. Just something I want to keep in mind. Although remember, there are certain contraindications to triptans, right? So say, for example, you have a history of MI, or you have a history of like vasospasm. So let's say, for example, you have a history of like variant angina, which we used to call Prinz Medal angina back in the day. Sumatriptan may not be the smartest idea in the world, right? So just kind of keep that in mind. Believe it or not, NSAIDs can also be used for acute migraine management on the USMLE exams. But one thing our friends at the MBMEs love to test is when you see people having migraines multiple times a month, then those people need to be on some kind of prophylaxis. So what kind of prophylaxis are they supposed to be on your exams? Well, the thing is, you can use many different things. You can use a beta blocker, you can use a tricyclic antidepressant, you can use topiramate, you can use calcium channel blockers, believe it or not. You can even use a TCA, I believe I've mentioned that already. So here's the thing. Many of you may wonder, man, Divine, which one do I pick? Well, in general, if they don't give you the person having any comorbid disorder, just pick the answer choice that is the least toxic. I will say probably of all these drugs, I don't know, maybe like a beta blocker or calcium channel blocker is probably the least toxic. But the thing is, many times on the USMLEs, they will give you these migraine prophylaxis questions. And they will give you like a comorbid disorder where it's like, wow, you can kill two birds with one stone by picking this drug, right? So say, for example, the person has migraines and they have peripheral neuropathy, or they have migraines and they have depression, then a tricyclic antidepressant is not a bad idea because it's going to manage the neuropathy, it's going to manage the depression, it's going to manage the person's migraines. Okay, how about beta blockers? Well, beta blockers, really good idea. Say, for example, the person has a history of something that can be treated with beta blockers, right? I can probably make a podcast on beta blockers in the future, actually. But there are so many things you treat with beta blockers, right? Like say, for example, the person is hyperthyroid and they have migraines. Beta blockers are pretty good because beta blockers will help the hyperadrenergic symptoms of the migraines. But not just that, they are also going to help with the person's, the hyperadrenergic symptoms of their hyperthyroidism, but it will also help with their migraine symptoms. Beta blockers, right? If a person has like angina and they have migraines, beta blockers make a lot of sense, right? So just kind of keep that in mind. Calcium channel blockers, again, we can use them for angina, we can use them for variant angina, we can use them for hypertension, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind. Although, you know, most times if we're dealing with a headache disorder and we're trying to give a person a calcium channel blocker, we're thinking more along the lines of the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil, for example. So, and verapamil is not used to manage hypertension. So I take that back, actually. So verapamil, right, is something we can use for angina for sure, not for hypertension. For hypertension, you're going to use more of the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like amlodipine, felodipine, and things of that nature. Topiramate for seizure disorders, right? But it's also, again, pretty good for migraine prophylaxis, right? And again, a quick thing I want to say is, what's the most common cause of headaches? You can get like these straight up epidemiology questions on your exams. What's the most common of the big three headaches, right? Between tension, cluster, and migraines. What is the most common? It's going to be tension. Remember, tension headaches tend to be bilateral. And then the one that is the second most common is migraines. Remember, migraines tend to be worsened by, you know, loud sounds, light, photophobia, stuff like that. They may be nauseous, they may be vomiting. And then remember, cluster headaches are the least common of the big three. They're the least common of the big three. Remember, those people tend to have like, it's a unilateral headache, red eye, you know, they tend to have eye findings on the same side. Now, there are some distractors, though, that are you probably want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams if you're dealing with headaches, especially migraines. There are some distractors that you may think that, oh, I'm reading a migraine question, but they're testing something completely different. So say, for example, they can give you a question about a person that has like this severe sudden onset headache on one side, worsened by loud sounds and light, but this person doesn't have any history of migraines. And they give you like a crazy high blood pressure in the Q-stem, When you see stuff like that, I would really hope you're saying, oh, divine, this person probably has a subarachnoid hemorrhage. You should get a non-contrast head CT in that case. Remember, subarachnoid hemorrhage can cause like this thunderclapper headache. Another classic distractor they can give you is a person that has, again, pain very bad on one side of the head, but worsened by loud sounds, lights, yada, yada, yada. You're like, oh, this is migraine. But then you see this person having like this nasty, nasty fever, this crazy leukocytosis, this sepsis-like picture, that person has meningitis. That person has meningitis, right? Probably bacterial meningitis. And then what if they give you a question about a person that is over 50 and they've been having these very severe one-sided headaches and things like that? If you see that, you want to think about a brain cancer. Person probably has a brain tumor of some sort. You need to get some kind of brain imaging in that person. All right, so let's kind of work through some rapid fire thingies. I just wanted to kind of hit those topics with this rapid review, but let's run through some rapid fire things and then we'll kind of wrap this podcast up, right? So what if they give you a question about an obese guy that has a very loud P2 heart sound? Remember, whenever you hear a loud P2, a person has pulmonary hypertension. What's going on in this person's life? This person has obstructive sleep apnea. Although this person could also have obesity hypoventilation syndrome. So how do you differentiate between those two disorders? Well, just check their PACO2, their PACO2 during the day, right? So if you have daytime hypercapnia, that person has obesity hypoventilation syndrome. The management is pretty much the same. You're going to get a sleep study, you're going to get a polysomnogram, and then the person is going to be placed on CPAP. Okay, especially this person with pulmonary hypertension. If they're pretty obese, you need to do something about that obesity. Okay, what if you get a question about an old guy, you know, that has like rising creatinine and he sleeps poorly at night because he always seems to get up a lot to go and pee. This person has BP. This person has benign prostatic hyperplasia. So remember, for this person, when you go ahead and check their post void residual volumes, it's going to be pretty high because they're not able to empty their bladders well enough at all. And some other things you may see on your exams is, you know, this person, you probably want to put them on an alpha-1 blocker to open up the bladder next so they can pee. But long term, you can consider things like finasteride or dutasteride. Those are 5-alpha reductase inhibitors that decrease the production of DHT that can shrink the prostate and relieve their BPH symptoms. Okay, now what if you see serious fatigue, sore throat in a young female? What should you be thinking about? I would hope you're saying, oh, divine, wait, this is infectious mononucleosis. This is literally infectious mononucleosis. Remember, people that have infectious mononucleosis, you can do the monospot test. It's caused by EBV. And remember, people that have mono, if you give them a drug like ampicillin, they can have this full body rash. And a classic temptation on exams is to say, oh, because they had this full body rash, I can never give them ampicillin or amoxicillin anymore. No, it is not an allergic reaction. Those people can literally get ampicillin or amoxicillin in the future. Just one of those weird things you may not see discussed in many resources, but it's very, very high yield to know for your exams. Okay, now what if they give you a question about like a young person, like a young male that has sex with other men, and this person has chronic fatigue, weight loss, fever, myalgias, you know, generalized lymphadenopathy. What is that? That's acute HIV syndrome. That is literally acute HIV syndrome. They love to test acute HIV syndrome on the exams. Obviously, for those people, you're going to test them for HIV. And then you're hopefully going to put them on highly active antiretroviral therapy. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about like very serious fatigue in a woman that has, you know, heavy menstrual bleeding and, you know, her bleeding times are elevated and she has an elevated PTT? When you see something like this, I want you to think of iron deficiency anemia. I know you may be like, divine, this person has von Willebrand disease. Yeah, I know. They have von Willebrand disease. But the thing is, our friends at the MBMEs may not even put von Willebrand disease as an answer. They may literally put iron deficiency anemia as an answer. So I know many of you may be scratching your heads like, divine, really? Yeah, really. This iron deficiency anemia is causing fatigue. Anemia classically on the exams causes fatigue. So what's the link there? Well, first things first, this person has von Willebrand disease. That's an autosomal dominant disorder where you have a deficiency of von Willebrand factor. Well, if you don't make von Willebrand factor, then you're going to have a very, very bad time trying to do the first step of primary hemostasis. So those people's bleeding time is going to go up. But remember, von Willebrand factor is like a protecting group. It's like a big brother. It's like a private security for factor 8. So when you lack von Willebrand factor, factor 8 will have a shorter half-life. So your coagulation cascade will not work very great. So your PTT, not your PT, your PTT is going to be elevated. So these people tend to bleed a lot. If you bleed a lot, you're going to be losing a lot of blood. That can cause you to develop an iron deficiency anemia. That's going to make you become very fatigued. People that are anemic, they are classically quite fatigued. In fact, if you see serious fatigue in a woman that is pregnant, you should probably screen her for iron deficiency anemia. So, and you know, there are actually a couple of other things they could ask you with this iron deficiency anemia business. Like, for example, what's going to be true of the person's blood oxygen carrying capacity? It's going to be decreased, right? It's going to be decreased. I remember when you have anemia, you don't have enough hemoglobin. If you don't have enough hemoglobin, then you're not going to be carrying enough oxygen in your blood. Although what will be true of these people's SaO2, their hemoglobin saturation with oxygen, it's going to be completely normal. That has nothing to do with anything. Their hemoglobin saturation will be completely normal. What will be true of their p little AO2? That's also going to be completely normal as well, right? Because the fact that you have anemia does not mean that blood is oxygen is unable to dissolve in your plasma. Just kind of keep those things in mind. And what will be true of these people's heart rate? If you have chronic anemia, what will be true of your heart rate? I hope you're seeing divine, it's going to be elevated, right? Because again, if your blood oxygen carrying capacity is diminished, your tissues are going to be hypoxic. Whenever there's tissue hypoxia, that's typically accompanied by an increase in cardiac output because you want to perfuse those tissues better. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a 35-year-old female that has been very fatigued for the last 2 months and she has diplopia and she has like blurry vision, especially at night? You want to think about myasthenia gravis, right? I remember people have myasthenia gravis. They have these anti-acetylcholine receptor antibodies. And remember, for those people, not a bad idea to get a chest CT just to screen them for thymomas. Thymomas have a very strong association with myasthenia gravis. And remember, for these people, after they're diagnosed, you got to put them on pharmacotherapy. You want to put them on a drug like pyridostigmine. Pyridostigmine is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor that's going to inhibit acetylcholinesterase, going to bump up your levels of acetylcholine so that you can now compete those nasty antibodies, those nasty autoantibodies that you're seeing on the surfaces of the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. And remember, again, the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor is an ion channel. Okay, it is not a G protein coupled receptor. It's one of these bizarre things that you may be like, oh, I only needed to worry about that on step one. But then you get a step two CK question, you get a step three question, you're like, whoa, where did this come from? So, whoa, I am telling you right now. Those nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, they are ion channels. They're actually some pretty high yield ion channels I'll say you should try to know for your exams. Number one is the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. It's an ion channel. And then number two is the GABA receptor. It's a chloride channel. That is where benzos and barbiturates work. Remember, benzos, they increase the frequency of opening of the GABA receptor. Barbiturates increase the duration of opening of the GABA receptor. Don't forget those for your exams. The nicotinic acetylcholine receptor transmits sodium ions. Something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Okay, now, what if you see chronic fatigue, bradycardia in like a female that is infertile? What are you thinking about? I would hope you're thinking about a person that has Hashimoto's. Remember, if you're hypothyroid, you're going to be very, very fatigued. You're going to be very, very fatigued. Very, very fatigued. And remember, they're going to be bradycardic because they're not putting beta-1 receptors on the surfaces of their cardiac cells. Remember, one of the jobs of T3 is to help you insert more beta-1 receptors on the surfaces of your myocardial cells. So if you don't have enough beta-1 receptors being inserted, you're not going to be able to respond to catecholamines like norepinephrine very well. So you're going to become a bradycardic. And you wonder, why are they infertile? Well, pretty simple. If you think about it, if you're hypothyroid, your T3, T4 is low, are you going to have negative feedback in the hypothalamus? No, you're not going to have that. So your TRH is going to skyrocket, your thyrotropin releasing hormone. Well, the thing about TRH is that it's also a very powerful stimulant for prolactin production. So you're going to have hyperprolactinemia, and prolactin is a very powerful inhibitor of GnRH. So you're going to become infertile. You're going to have a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. What do I mean by that? Well, your gonadotropins are going to be low. Your GnRH is going to be low because prolactin is shutting it down. So obviously, if your GnRH is low, your FSH will be low, your LH will be low, your estrogen, your testosterone is going to be low. Right? So you're going to have infertility because your HPG axis pretty much does not work. All right. So hypogonadotropic because your gonadotropins are low. Hypogonadism because your actual gonad is not being stimulated. So your gonad is not producing enough sex hormones. All right. So what if you see like severe headache, brain bleed in a person that went to a pizza parlor or a person that went to a winery, and this person is a depressed person that has like treatment-resistant depression, was recently started on some kind of pharmacotherapy. Well, I hope you're thinking about MAOI toxicity, monoamine oxidase inhibitor toxicity. I remember your monoamine oxidase inhibitors are going to be drugs like isocarboxazid or tranylcypromine. Tranylcypromine is spelled as tranylcypromine. And then isocarboxazid is spelled as isocarboxazid. I believe that's the right spelling, right? So remember, these things can cause a thyramine crisis. So what's the pathophase? Because many people just memorize it, thyramine crisis. Well, what's the pathophase? Well, here's the thing. Normally, monoamine oxidase in your GI tract breaks down thyramine. But if you're taking a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, then you won't break down thyramine. You're going to reabsorb it in your GI tract. And thyramine is like a false neurotransmitter, like it's like a false catecholamine in a sense. Basically, what it does is that it displaces catecholamines like norepinephrine from synaptic vesicles. So if you're, it's almost like the carbon monoxide for your catecholamines. Remember, carbon monoxide kind of hits up hemoglobin and then oxygen can bind. So basically, what thyramine does is that it binds to synaptic vesicles that contain catecholamines, so it displaces them. So those catecholamines are just released into the synapse. You're going to get a nasty, nasty hypertensive crisis. Remember, we tend to get this from like cheeses, meats, wines, things of that nature. Okay, so I guess as we wrap up today, I want to end up with people that have red skin. You know, people that have like skin flushing or skin that's just really red. This is like a very classic kind of USMLE vignette. There are many things they go after with that. So if they give you like an IV drug user that was started on pharmacotherapy, has red skin, think of vancomycin, right? Remember, vancomycin causes you to release more histamine, and histamine is a very prominent vasodilator, so that can cause you to have red skin. They give you a question about a person that has a narrow complex regular tachyarrhythmia. You're thinking about an SVT, a supraventricular tachycardia. One of the ways you can rapidly abort an SVT is with adenosine. Adenosine is a very good, very amazing vasodilator that can cause you to have skin flushing. I mean, think about it. Why do you think your skin flushes when you exercise? Why do you think that happens? When you exercise, your muscles are working overtime. So you're breaking down ATP to ADP, ADP to AMP, AMP to adenosine. Adenosine is a very powerful vasodilator. And that's actually useful because if you dilate the vessels, the blood vessels that feed your muscle, you're going to get better perfusion of that muscle so you can keep working out. Okay, so that's one of the reasons why your skin is flushed. It's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then remember, if they give you a question about a person that's trying to raise their HDL and, you know, they're taking like some supplement to get their lipid levels good, because, you know, think of niacin, because niacin doesn't only raise HDL. So again, remember, it's the best at raising HDL, but it also lowers LDL and it also lowers your triglycerides. But again, it's not as good at lowering LDL like your HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors, those are your statins. And it's not as good as lowering your triglycerides like your PPAR alpha agonists, like your fibrates. So things like gemfibrozil, fenofibrates, clofibrates, things like that. But it can do those things. Think of niacin. Think of niacin, right? And then they give you a question about a person studied on an antihypertensive and they have peripheral edema and their skin gets red and flushed and whatnot. Think of calcium channel blockers. Calcium channel blockers, your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like amlodipine, felodipine, and things like that, they can cause flushing of the skin. Because remember, these things are very good arteriolar dilators. So because they dilate your arterioles, there's going to be more blood flow through your body. That more blood flow is going to cause you to have a reddening of your skin. You're going to have skin flushing. Although remember, why do they cause that peripheral edema? Well, they cause it because by dilating arterioles, what are you doing to your systemic capillaries? You're literally sending more blood to your systemic capillaries. As you send more blood to your systemic capillaries, you're going to increase the hydrostatic pressures within those systemic capillaries. That's going to cause fluid extravasation. You're going to get peripheral edema. Is there some way you could treat that? I've talked about this in previous podcasts before. You can give something that can dilate your systemic venules, like ACE inhibitors. Because ACE inhibitors, when they dilate those venules, they're going to be pulling blood away from the capillaries. Because remember, your capillaries are fed by arterioles and they are drained by venules. So if you dilate those venules, you're going to be draining those capillaries. You're going to bring down the hydrostatic pressures within those capillaries. And that's going to reduce that fluid extravasation. You're going to have less peripheral edema. All right. Now, what if they give you this reddening of the skin in a person that has like erectile dysfunction or a person that has hypopituitarism, signs of hypopituitarism? Think of hereditary hemochromatosis, right? Because remember, in hereditary hemochromatosis, these people just have crazy amounts of iron reabsorption. So all that excess iron reabsorption is going to cause problems because iron loves to generate free radicals. And those free radicals can cause damage in your pituitary. So they may have signs of hypothyroidism like bradycardia and whatnot. They may have signs of adrenal insufficiency, like they can have low blood pressure, because remember, cortisol has a permissive effect on your sympathetic nervous system. So you're going to have, those people are going to be not very vasoactive because they're in a cortisol deficient state, because, they have hypopituitarism, so they're not making ACTH, so they're not stimulating the adrenal cortex. So they can have all these problems. They can have all these electrolyte anomalies, because when you have a cortisol deficiency, cortisol kind of works like aldosterone in a sense. So when you have a cortisol deficiency, you're probably going to have some kind of hyperkalemia, you're going to have some kind of hyponatremia. And remember, those people can also, just have many, many different issues. But remember, they will not have skin hyperpigmentation because of the low, because of their hypocortisolism. No, in fact, these people actually have low levels of ACTH. So please, let me take a step back, because hereditary hemochromatosis causes your skin to be red because you have a ton of iron kind of running around in your body. Okay, that skin hyperpigmentation is not because of ACTH. If you have hypopituitarism from hereditary hemochromatosis, you're not going to have high ACTH. Because again, many people think that, when a person has low cortisol, their ACTH is going to skyrocket and then they'll have skin hyperpigmentation. No. It depends on the cause of the hypocortisolism. If you have hypopituitarism, your pituitary gland is gone. If it's not working, you're not going to be making ACTH. If you're not making ACTH, you certainly are not making MSH, melanocyte stimulating hormone. Remember, those two things come from an ancestral molecule known as POMC, right? So remember, the cause of the hypocortisolism determines if you have skin hyperpigmentation or not. So say, for example, you have Addison's disease, where your adrenal glands have been torched by autoantibodies. Then, of course, you're not making cortisol. There's no negative feedback. But your anterior pituitary is still intact. So you're going to make a ton of ACTH. You're going to make a ton of melanocyte stimulating hormone as well. So you're going to have skin hyperpigmentation. But not so, absolutely not so, when we're dealing with hypocortisolism, because you have like a pituitary or some kind of hypothalamic disorder. Just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. And again, you can have erectile dysfunction. That's a very classic presentation of hereditary hemochromatosis. And remember, it's an autosomal recessive disease where you have a HFE mutation and just reabsorb a ton of iron from your gut. And that just causes a lot of problems. That iron can also torch their pancreas, so they can develop diabetes. They can have many problems from those things. And then final vignette we'll talk about, right? We see a person that has, again, reddening of the skin, and they have like hypertension, they have headaches, they have a lot of like chronic urticaria, especially with showers. Think of polycythemia vera, right? Remember, that's a JAK2 mutation. They have a ton of hemoglobin. And so because they have a ton of hemoglobin, their blood is very viscous. If your blood is very viscous, remember Poiseuille's law, your total peripheral resistance is going to go up. That's going to cause you to have a, high blood pressure. And again, they'll have all these headaches because their blood is so thick. Blood is barely flowing in their brains. They can have ischemia and all those things. Remember, those people can also get Budd-Chiari syndrome on the USMLE exams, right? That's like thrombosis of the hepatic vein. All right, I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. The rapid review series has gone on for long enough. But again, just real quick, I know you want to go, but I will encourage you just listen to this real quick. So if you're interested in any of my USMLE courses for step one, I have like a 25-hour step one class in July. It takes place from the 1st to the 5th of July. And that class is also good for people that are taking step two or step three and they have poor basic science foundations, or you failed your step one. You should definitely take that class. But starting next week on Tuesday, I have a bunch of classes for step one all the way to step three. I have a test taking strategies class. I have on Tuesday, I have a biostats class on Wednesday. I have a social sciences and ethics class on Thursday. I have a last minute review on Friday. The last minute review, though, is just for step two and step three. And these classes are all over Zoom. And then the week after that, I have a 20-hour step two, step three class. Obviously, also useful for people taking complex level two and three. And then starting from June 1st to June 14th, I have a 50-hour step two, step three class. That is a class that has a very limited attendance. I can't accept too many people into that class because I want to invest in everyone that attends. So there is definitely a hard cap on that. It's a 50-hour class. We go over like 500 multiple choice questions, make a lot of integrations, teach a lot of critical thinking. And that class is held once every year because it's such a huge time commitment. But again, I'm telling you, if you attend that class, there are people that have attended it last year. They found it to be extremely helpful. So if you're interested, shoot me an email. And these classes are not lectures. They're all scenarios. Exam style scenarios, MBME style questions, where you just become an expert at MBMEs. If you like the way I explain things, I explain pathophase, make integrations, you're going to love my classes. You're going to love my classes. I've made separate podcasts where I talk about these classes. And if you want more information, you can shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. I also offer one-on-one tutoring. And I help with many other things like the ERAS application, recommendation letters, personal statements, mock interviews. And I tutor again one-on-one for all the USMLEs, all the complex exams, all the med school exams. And then I also have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. So you can check that out if you want. And I have a YouTube channel where I post videos that I make. And then finally, I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post like one or two podcasts, usually two podcasts, where from a biblical perspective, I discuss a life lesson. So if you're and actually there's an Apple podcast associated with that, and it's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. Again, the website is DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. So just check that out. I think you'll find it to be extremely helpful. So I will see you in the next podcast. Again, I really hope that you enjoy this worksheet and you use it to study and it helps you in the future. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Bye for now. Thank you.